was an important leader of ancient Israel. He was the last of the judges and the first of the major prophets. In the book named for him, we read this. And Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. What all of this means is Samuel did or said nothing that wasn't godly. Because of this, the people listened to every single word Samuel said. He had a godly reputation, and God thought enough of him to speak to him in a time when God wasn't speaking to anybody. It is during Samuel's tenure when the disaster of all disasters happens. The Ark of the Covenant was captured. The Ark of the Covenant was a sacred object. It was not to be tampered with. It had rings on its sides, and poles were inserted through the rings, and only the priests were allowed to carry the ark, but only with the poles. You couldn't touch the box proper, because the golden box had the power to strike men dead. Just ask poor Uzzah. The ark was made of wood and covered inside and out with gold. Inside were three holy objects: Aaron's sacred rod, which was used to perform the miracles in front of Pharaoh. There was the manna, which was what God gave to the children of Israel to eat in the wilderness. And then there were the tablets of stone with the Ten Commandments inscribed upon them. To the ancient Israelite, the ark was a powerful symbol of God's presence. God's glory rested upon it. It came to occupy the most revered spot in all of Jerusalem, the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Solomon. This sacred object gets stolen by the Philistines, after the Israelites bring it out to war, because they were thinking, if we bring this out to war, it'll be like a lucky charm and it will help us win the war. Capture the Flag is a game that the teenagers at Wheaton Wesleyan Church love to play. This game is played in the dark. I don't know what's wrong with teenagers, but they love to play games in the dark, and I don't, which is why I don't work with kids anymore. In order to play this game, we had to divide into two teams, and each team was given a flag and half of the church's property. The teams would scatter to hide their flag on their half of the property. Hiding the flag was of the utmost importance. It had to be hidden in a place where some of it could be seen. You couldn't just hide it somewhere where you couldn't see it at all. In other words, it kind of had to be hidden in plain sight. And after the flags were hidden, the game officially begins. The object of the game is to sneak into enemy territory and capture their flag. When this happens, the game is over. Victory and spoils of war go to the team who captures their opponent's flag, which meant basically, you got to have the snacks first. Because of this, the flag is guarded to the death. Everything hinges on your ability to protect your flag. Losing your flag was the worst possible thing that could happen. The Israelites' flag was the Ark of the Covenant. Losing it was the worst possible thing that could happen. When the news of the Ark's capture had been broadcast, Samuel's mentor, Eli, fell off his perch and broke his neck. Eli's daughter-in-law goes into preterm labor and dies. Yes, losing the Ark was that bad. Reading from 1 Samuel 3 through 4. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant before the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. Basically, because they are losing, they decide to bring the ark out as a rabbit's foot. At first, the Philistines are terrified by the presence of the ark. But after their initial shock of seeing the Israelites' most holy possession in the war, the Philistines decide, we're going to make a play for it. 1 Samuel 4, 10 through 11. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell. And the ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. As it turns out, the Ark of the Covenant wasn't a lucky charm for the Israelites, and it wasn't a lucky charm for the Philistines either. 1 Samuel 5, 1 through 4. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. When the Philistines bring the ark into their temple, their god, Dagon, keeps falling down as if in worship to the ark. Finally, in the presence of this holy relic, Dagon falls to pieces, and the Philistines are plagued with boils. The Philistines couldn't wait to get rid of the ark now. It had become the equivalent of a black cat crossing in front of you. After the ark is returned, Samuel calls the people to public repentance, promising them if they did, they would be delivered from the Philistines. So a revival breaks out. As the ark is being brought back into Israeli territory, the people weep with joy. This revival did not, nor could it have, occurred until the ark was back where it belonged. The revival was impossible until the sacred was made sacred again. Likewise, we will not experience a revival in our country or in our world until the sacred is made sacred again. Which leads me to this. What is sacred? Well, this sanctuary, for example, is sacred. Leviticus 19:30 says, "Show reverence toward my sanctuary. I am the Lord." The Bible is sacred. Marriage is sacred. Baptism is sacred. Dedicating children to God is sacred. The opposite of sacred is profane. We're used to hearing that swear words are profanity. However, not all swear words are technically profane. Some of them are your basic run-of-the-mill curse words. When somebody says H-E double hockey sticks, that's a curse word. When someone damns another person, that's a curse word. What makes a word profane is when sacred things are spoken of in crass, obscene, or careless ways. The meaning of the word profane means outside of the temple. That which is profane is something that is unworthy to be in the temple. It's too unholy. It's too polluted, and so it is to be cast outside. God is sacred. So when we use the name of God inappropriately, we are profane. The Marriage Act is sacred. So when we use four-letter words to describe it, we are profane. The human body is sacred. So when we use four-letter words to describe body parts, we are profane. Whenever we use words that make something sacred unholy, we're being profane. We are living in a time when the profane is smothering the sacred. There is an avalanche of unholiness which flows right into our homes through the internet. There is no place in this culture that is untouched by the profane. You can't even go shopping without hearing profane music played over the PA system. The most recent public example of the profane was the opening ceremonies of the Olympic Games in Paris. It featured a burlesque performance of the Last Supper, after which Dionysus, the pagan god of weird sex and insanity, danced on the table. He was busy exposing parts of himself better left to the imagination. And keep in mind, this was being done the whole time a little girl was sitting at the table. The portrayal of the Last Supper was a mockery of a seminal moment in Christianity where Christ instituted Holy Communion. This was not an accident. This was not an attempt, as the Paris Olympic organizers claimed, to send a message of love and tolerance. Recently, in the last couple days, we're being told that you guys are just too sensitive. This wasn't the Last Supper. This was the Feast of Dionysus. Well, the problem with that is the title printed on the program for the ceremony was actually titled The Scene of the Lord's Supper on the Sign. Then there was that pesky little post from the star of the show, Barbara Butch. Miss Butch quickly deleted her post, but nothing ever dies on the internet. I really didn't pay much attention to anything else last week except for this. And I studied it hard, and I listened to a lot of podcasts on it, and I did a lot of reading. And I have concluded that this was both. It was a portrayal of the Lord's Supper, and it ended in a pagan ceremony. To me, the symbolism was clear. Let's replace Christianity with paganism. This is a vivid reminder that we are in an intense spiritual battle, and perhaps it is the most intense spiritual battle of our lifetimes. Oddly, despite claims that the ceremony had nothing to do with the Lord's Supper, Olympic organizers quickly apologized, saying, clearly, there was never an intention to show disrespect to any religious group. If people have taken any offense, we are, of course, really, really sorry. It was pretty clear to me that this was disrespectful, and I'm not sure offense is a big enough word for something so starkly profane. However, this may come as a surprise to you, I am not personally offended, because Christians like me aren't the primary target. Jesus Christ, the Holy One, our Holy One, was the target. To make everybody sure who the real target was, the aforementioned Barbara Butch acted the part of Jesus. And then a golden calf was brought out and worshiped, and a white horse appeared at the end. People have assumed that the white horse was the one found in Revelation 6:2, which reads, I looked, and there before me was a white horse. Its rider held a bow, and he was given a crown, and he rode out as a conqueror bent on a conquest. This rider on this horse is the Antichrist, and he is not the object of this mockery. The more I analyzed this, the more sure I was that it was the other white horse found in Revelation 19:11. I saw heaven standing open, and there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True. The rider here is Jesus. I believe the white horse seen in the Olympics opening is this one. It is a satanic mockery of Christ's victory lap at the end of Revelation, which now might be a good time to plug Sunday school that's coming up in the fall. We are going to study Revelation, and we can study things like this. It'll be very interesting. It's been mostly Catholics and Muslims who've been speaking out against the blasphemy in Paris. But no matter who was speaking out, it seemed to have a positive effect. Major advertisers pulled out, and the loss of thousands of dollars caused a lot of backpedaling. The organizers are making sure that we can't see videos of the ceremony anymore. The French equivalent to the DOJ is issuing cease and desist letters to those who are trying to show the videos. And I can't guarantee you that Facebook won't cut our live stream because of the pictures that I am showing this morning. Now that our complaints have been lodged, and they've been heard, I really do think they have, what's next? Do we just sit around and keep belly aching? I'm not really sure how that helps us or the lost souls who engaged in this profanity. And by the way, they are lost, and we should care. I came up with three things that I think we can do starting today. And the first one is follow the example of two Old Testament men, Daniel and Job. What Daniel and Job did when the people acted in unholy ways was confess. Daniel 9, 4 through 5. I prayed to the Lord my God and made confession, saying, O Lord, the great and awesome God, who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, we have sinned and done wrong and acted wickedly and rebelled, turning aside from your commandments and rules. Job 1, 5. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. Neither Daniel or Job are repenting for the sins of others. That's not really possible. What they were doing was confessing. Confession is the admission that what happened is wrong. It is an agreement with God that certain actions or words are sinful. And I think that's exactly where we start. We admit and agree with God that we as people have become profane. The second thing I think we can do is remember our position in our culture. 1 Peter 2:9, but you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. We are called by God to be holy and to shine a light in the darkness. One day after the profane Olympic opening, Paris was plunged into darkness following a blackout. However, amid the widespread blackout, one light shone brightly upon the Basilica of the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Maybe the blackout reflected God's mood about the blasphemous portrayal of his son. Or maybe the light was a reminder that we are called to be in a world, and we are called to be the light in a world that has been darkened by sin. Matthew 5, 14, you are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. And the third and the final thing that I think we can do, and maybe this should have been number one, it's put God in his rightful place. We all know God is not in his rightful place in our country. We all know that. If we go to a secular speech and we say, well, we want to say a prayer in the name of Buddha,
yeah, great.
We want to say a prayer in the name of Muhammad,
yep,
great. Well, we want to say a prayer in the name of Jesus. Nope, separation of church and state. We all know that God is not in his rightful place today. We need to put him back, personally and then corporately. It wasn't until the Israelites put the ark back in its rightful place that true spiritual revival occurred. I have said for years, I have heard other people say for years, this country needs a revival, and we do. We do. But if we are serious and we really want this true spiritual revival, we've got to put God in his rightful place. It's never going to happen until we do. When I first came to this church, I found a print of Warner Solomon's Portrait of Christ. It's hanging out in our lobby this morning. I was so excited when I found it, because it is my favorite portrait of Christ, even though it doesn't look like Jesus at all. But my joy quickly faded when I saw that it was ripped and dirty and full of cobwebs. To me, something very sacred had been desecrated. And so I showed it to Andre, and I expressed my dismay at finding such a beautiful, sacred picture of Christ in such terrible shape. So Andre took the print and he repaired it. But what he did was more than iron out the wrinkles, clean up the dirt, and reframe it. He restored the sacred. I challenge us to do likewise. Restore the sacred. Like the Israelites of old, real spiritual revival will come to our country when we restore God back to his proper place. His place is a place of honor. It is a place of sacredness. It is a place of blessing. Do you want spiritual revival in this country? I do. Let us put God back where he belongs.